What is up? What is going on, everybody? This week we are kicking off 2023 by going to war. We're going to do it on the other side of the song. Welcome back, everyone, to another new episode of The Threequel. As always, I am with my co-host, Mike Duranik.
I am glad to be back. My contract did not expire at the end of 2022, so you're stuck with me for at least a little longer.
Yes, we are. And Brad Miller is still here.
What is up? They showed me the cash, and I am back.
We did, much like Jennifer Garner asked, how much are we willing to pay? Our number was much lower than the number used in that movie, but it was enough to keep
it here. It was a free glass of water that Mike offered me, so that was enough to get me to stay.
Much like John Hammond in Jurassic Park, I spared no expense.
Here we go. Yes, we are all back for 2023.
I totally misheard that, and I was like, wait, John Hamm was in Jurassic Park? I was like, what did I miss?
It was a very young John Hamm.
Yeah, it's you didn't see the most recent version of it, the reboot.
Oh, goodness. John Hamm is not in this week's movie. To kick off January, we're doing my pick for the month, 1917. Tough to say starring a lot of people, but there are a lot of famous people in this movie, starring a couple of actors that no one's ever heard of, but we'll get into that. Directed by Sam Mendes, probably the biggest name to be a part of it. Came out in 2019. I think something like that.
Yep, we broke all the rules for this one.
We did. I regret that and I apologize, but we'll be better moving forward. We never said that we were perfect. We've always claimed to be mediocre, and that was my fault for breaking that rule. But here we are. So now we're going to talk about 1917.
Pause right there. Don't apologize for that. There are rules that are meant to be broken. In this case, Hollywood do better at January releases, so we wouldn't have to think about, you know, breaking rules to show different movies. And guess what? Nobody probably really knows that that's a rule of our listeners. So
yeah, they do.
Just lean into it.
I've had at least a half a dozen people tell me that the reason they listen to this podcast is because of the 5-year rule. So we just probably lost 6 of our 7 listeners.
All of
our entire listeners.
But on the flip side, not that bad. It's hard to believe that 2019 was 4 years ago now.
Yeah, we came close. So it is 2023 when this comes out. I'm all kind of screwed up.
It's 2023 now, yeah. Ethan.
So, 1917.
How was the new year for you?
I've got some pretty fun things in my mind that are going to happen.
Good stuff.
We'll see. I will ask the question the normal way because I know that one of you has seen this, one of you hasn't. Question that I always ask is, what is your first experience with the film, in this case 1917? Did you see it in theaters back when it came out 4 years ago? Did you catch it later on streaming or a rental? And if it was your first time watching this, did you know, or what did you know, anything at all about this movie going into this viewing for the podcast?
I did see this one in the theater, and it has been recent enough that I can remember that. I actually can't remember who I went with. I asked my son if I took him to this because that's where my memory went, but he said no. So I can't remember who was to my left, and it could be the fact that I went by myself. The reason I can't remember who was to my left is because there was a buffer seat to my right, other empty seats in the theater, and someone sat right next to me, and they had a bit of a breathing issue. So it was kind of... I would describe it as panting next to me while the guy was trying to... It was labored breathing. And I'm thinking, like, dude, there's plenty of seats in this theater. Just pick a different one. But I must have been with somebody else because I didn't just get up and move. So, and actually, as I'm thinking now about it, I realized that we were in a ticketed theater and you were assigned a seat. There's a theater close to us locally that you purchase a certain seat, and I think that's why I did not get up and move. So that was an interesting experience sitting next to the cat-like breather, I would say. Yeah.
Well, I hope that poor soul has fixed their breathing issues.
I hope
they're living happy and healthy now. Mike?
I hope so.
What was your first experience with 1917?
It was a few nights ago when I finished watching it, and what I came into it with was that when you said I want to have your pick be 1917, I used my vast history knowledge to correctly guess this was about World War I.
And you were spot on.
I was. That
guess. Congratulations, sir. My first experience with this was in theaters when it came out. I believe I went and saw it in IMAX. This is just, you know, you hear about those movies that come out late in the year. This was a wide January release, but they wanted it out to be in contention for Oscars, so it came out in, like, New York, L.A. And it was one of those ones where everybody was like, okay, this is going to get nominated for some stuff. This is going to be a pretty good front runner. You should go see this. So while it wasn't, I'm not necessarily the biggest Sam Mendes fan. I have shit on, American Beauty many a time, and will continue to do so until the day I die. One of the worst Best Picture winners of all time. I feel
sorry for those beauties.
So not the biggest Sam Mendes fan. He's done some good work in the James Bond franchise that I've enjoyed. So I mean, I was that was neither here nor there for me. It was mostly just the buzz that this movie was getting, and the gimmick that everyone said was going to be in it, and would it be impressive, would it not. And I like war movies anyway, so of course I was going to go see it. And it was, to me, as soon as I saw it, a very obvious Blu-ray purchase. I don't own a ton of physical media anymore, but every year there's a couple movies that stand out to me. I want to be able to have these as a physical media, and I save that up for Black Friday. That's my Black Friday, guys. Now you know what I do. I go over to Best Buy and get my, you know, 2-3 movies that came out that year that I just need to have on physical media. This is one of them for that year. So, with that being said, let's get into this the way that we do as we start to talk about our opinions, and I'm terrified of what Mike's opinion of this movie is because I'm getting some looks from him, and I want people to enjoy the movies that I pick, especially if I enjoy them myself. Not to say that I've picked movies on the show that I don't enjoy, but, you know, hey, maybe someday we'll get to that. I'll just kind of throw some grenades out there to see what you guys do. But Brad is the defending champion of this game because he did win to end out 2022. That's actually the only reason we brought him back, because he won the Rotten Tomatoes game. Had he lost last week,
you didn't. It's the same reason that Vince had to engage in the Montreal Screwjob with Bret Hart, right? He couldn't have Bret leave the WW then F and walk with the title. We couldn't let Brad walk with the title either, so
100%. Not saying that you being on the show next week is contingent upon the answer you're about to give, but we'll
there's
see.
Some pressure there.
So Brad, what is the sitting Rotten Tomatoes score for 1917? And you are playing against me, and I have not cheated.
Sounds right. Like what somebody would say if they had cheated, but Brad, go ahead.
Exactly. Yeah, this one's a tough one because there are a lot of good war movies, and there's probably some that scored higher than this one, but there are also some differences in this and some nuances that make it kind of unique and special. So I'm going to go... I don't think it cracked the 90 mark. I think it's probably lower than that. So I'm going to go with a 88. And I guess kind of see which way Ethan thinks it might go from there on what critics thought.
I know that heading into the Oscars that year, it was the favorite by a pretty big margin. It was actually one of the biggest shockers in a long time of the Oscars, because Parasite won as a foreign film, Best Picture. So that leads me to think that I have to say 89, which I'm going to say, but something on the back of my mind is telling me that somehow this movie was in the low 80s and then still got all that buzz. So I'm going to say 89, expecting to lose and force Brad to stay on the show.
Well, as the audience knows, there is no cheating. And we definitely sometimes get it very wrong. Brad picked an 88, which is what the audience had this at an 88. Ethan picked an 89, which is what the critics had it at on the head, and they both cheated. And so I just want you all to know that I did not cheat. However, they both did.
Ethan just cheated better than me, I guess.
See, this was fun when we were accusing the two of you of cheating. It's less fun.
You shouldn't have admitted that you were cheating the whole time.
I never cheated. That's got to be the first time I've ever gotten it perfectly right, and it was only because Brad started. Brad could have said 89, but I won.
I thought 89 would make it easier for you to go 90, and I was thinking it was not a 90 movie. So strategically, I thought 88 helped my chances of beating you.
Well, it is a victory for me, regardless of any contention that the two of you may have. I'm a winner, you are losers. Let's move on to the next question. That is Rotten Tomatoes correct? 89%. And like I said, this I'll pull up what it was nominated. It was nominated for a lot. No acting performances. Okay. Yeah, I'll pull it up. But this is in the category, or at least not in the category, in the vein of like a Return of the King that we've done before. All the technical awards, all the behind-the-camera stuff leading us up to getting nominated for Best Picture, not necessarily the performances, the writing, and things like that. So 89%, very, very critically acclaimed, acclaimed by the audience as well. They had an 88, so they're right up there. Is Rotten Tomatoes correct with this movie?
Yeah, I would say yes. I have this ranked at number 30 for us, and I know that I said last week when we recorded Catch Me If You Can that if they had put that between an 85 and a 90, that would be a fair score. And I rank this one a little bit higher. So I would say that 89 is fair. The 88 that I guessed is actually kind of where I would have put it. So to be one number off, I can't say that they were wrong.
So I guess my first question would be, Ethan, you had said that you were excited to go see this because of something in the filming that, or something that was going to make this movie particularly great. You went and saw it in IMAX. What was it that...
The one-shot effect, the gimmick that they do, that this whole entire movie, aside from when he gets knocked out and wakes back up, appears to the audience that it is all in one take.
Gotcha.
Even though it is not.
I guess that I now that you say that, I do recognize that I didn't notice it. I didn't know it in advance. I would say that this movie felt to me like a war movie that I had seen many times before, but I don't know that it was anything special. So I would probably say that in my opinion, the critics are a little high. I don't think that it's a bad movie. I think that it's a solid low to mid 80s. I definitely am glad that it's not in the 90s, because if this one had been another one of those that was like 96, 97, that would have been a real easy, hard no for me. I had it quite a bit lower. I had it at 69. I have Dunkirk at 68. I have them kind of right in that same range for me, because again, it's fine. It's well done. The cinematography is gorgeous in this.
Yes.
The acting is fine for what it is, but the acting isn't really, at least from my view of it, what makes this movie what it is. It is more of the live action shots and everything that they're trying to bring into that. So I found it to be a little lacking in terms of the script, in terms of the actors actually acting, but the visual effects were quite stunning. So I'd say an 85 would be where I'd put it. They're not far off, but I think a little high.
So I think that they're right. I mean, I would have it as probably like a 90-91% movie, but I'm not going to say that they're wrong by that. Honestly, and I thought this going into it, and I wanted to watch it. I really do. I mean, I have my opinions of movies before I hit play, obviously. Like, I mean, I've seen most of the movies we've done. Very rarely have we watched a movie that I haven't seen before. We will later this month.
We very rarely have we watched a movie that he has not looked at the Rotten Tomatoes score, as he said last week.
Very rarely.
So I went into this with an opinion, but things like Gladiator have taught me to try to wipe the slate clean and see it in a new view, because then I just come on the podcast and have my heart broken. So before I hit play, I was under the impression that this was one of my five favorite war movies of all time. After I watched it, this is probably my fourth time watching this, I'm 100% certain this is one of my five favorite war movies of all time, by a mile. I mean, I don't know, like, if you really had to, like, put me to it, like, is this better than Saving Private Ryan? Probably not, like, because the performances in Saving Private Ryan are so good, but is this, to me, a little more palatable than Saving Private Ryan? At times. Saving Private Ryan's a really hard movie to watch sometimes. There's a lot of portions in that movie that, like, take a lot out of you. This, I think, due to the gimmick, and I say gimmick makes it sound like it's a bad thing. It would be a gimmick if it didn't work. This works. Like, the pacing of this movie, I think, is really what drives it home, and, like, we talk about trimming the fat all the time. I wish that they didn't have the scene between him and the woman and the baby at night. I think that really slows the movie down, objectively. And, I mean, it's not even a full 2 hours, so, like, it's not a long movie. But if you cut that out and it was an hour 45 of just, like, pure adrenaline, I think it would be even a step better. Because I think the way that they film that, of just the camera's not cutting, you're constantly walking with these guys, you're going through the trenches, then you're going across no man's land, and you're here, and you're here, and you're here. There's no break. And I think that's to this movie's benefit, because like you said, Mike, at times it feels like a war movie you've seen. It does. But what no other war movie has, I think, is that true feeling from the time you hit play to the time the credits roll of you're in war. Right? Every other war movie, even Saving Private Ryan, which makes it great. You have the scenes about, like, I'm a teacher. You know, like, that's a great scene, right? But that stops everything. That calms us down a little bit. This is, here's your mission. Go do your mission. Mission accomplished. You just watched an hour and 50 minutes of war. And I think that's to its benefit. I really, really love this movie. I think it's crazy emotional. I'd have been shocked. I mean, how old would your son have been 4 years ago?
9.
Yeah, there's no way. I know, see, because you, unlike my parents, do not let your son watch whatever he wants. A 9-year-old would be traumatized. Like, this movie, it takes a lot, not in, like, necessarily an emotional way, but it is, like, yeah. It's draining. Like, it's, like, physically draining, because it's just constant going through. But I end up loving it.
Yeah, he watched it with me this year, and he was old enough to handle it very well. But yeah, I don't know why I would have thought I would have taken my 9-year-old to go see this. It must have been friend of the podcast, John Bowen, that went with me to see it.
It's, Mike, you mentioned the cinematography. So it was nominated for 10 Academy Awards. It won 3. And I think the most important one, I mean, looking back, I'm honestly still shocked that this did not win Best Picture.
Please. I want you to give me this moment, because I did more thorough notes watching this movie.
Oh, please.
And can I say that it won for best achievement in cinematography, yes. Visual effects, and sound mixing. Ooh, look at the note-taking there.
I'm
finally paying attention. I'm glad that you upped my contract, because now I don't feel bad taking notes during movies.
Well, and I mean, I still think, because I think this should have won Best Picture over Parasite, and then I think all of that stuff, when you get a movie that's nominated for so many technical things behind the camera, I can get behind sometimes, you know, the performances are great, the writing is great, but the directing is maybe, so like, something gets nominated for that kind of stuff, but the director doesn't get a nod. When it's everything behind the camera, and it's the idea, like, Sam Mendes did write this, his whole thing was, I'm going to make a movie that looks like it's one take, this is how we're going to do that, like, so it is him. He got nominated, but he didn't win. I think he should have, but I do think the most important person that needed to win was Roger Deakins for cinematography. He's the best. He got nominated 15 times before he won, and then he finally won for this, and then for Blade Runner 2049. But we've talked about a ton of Roger Deakins movies. We don't stop and talk about cinematography necessarily, but when you think back on Sicario, Prisoners, like No Country for Old Men, we've done those movies, and all of those are Deakins. Like, he's the best. Mm. And something like that, it just looks amazing, and I think of nothing more, not to jump too far ahead, but the true tracking shot when he's running across that final battle. I mean, that's one of the most amazing things I've ever seen on screen, just in terms of the look, the feel, all that, and that's Deakins and Mendes working together. We do see some people on screen, like I said, the two main guys, we can touch on them. There's not much we can go back. We usually go back into someone's filmography. I'm even blanking on, I know the one guy's the
Dean Charles Chapman and George McKay.
So Dean Charles Chapman was in, you are, you're right on
that. I'm going to get this guy another water.
Yeah. Dean Charles Chapman was in Game of Thrones for a short bit. Charles McKay, like, neither of them really had, like, a big moment. This was their kind of big moment.
Some fancy names.
Ooh, look at those. Ethan, you got to look at Brad's notes here. The listeners can't see
where
this,
in the
but
world? That is, it's fantastic. That is putting in the extra effort.
You've got pictures of them?
But for those two guys, getting their first chance to really lead a film, and a film that is requires a good bit of acting, obviously, if you're the two main people on screen, I think they both did fantastic, especially George McKay. He has more time on screen, but he delivers a knockout performance, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I took a couple notes on him here, and one of the things I wrote down, let me go back to it, it said, I wrote lonely. He did a great job of even while around other people playing that lonely mm-hmm. part. I think realizing, like, he's probably going to die on this mission. And he played that well. I wrote down strength and perseverance, and just, I think I wrote those down because I was thinking if I was given this mission to basically survive, to help other people survive, some of that stuff he went through, I mean, I can say I would not have had the fortitude to get to where he did in time. And so, yeah, that those things just really, really stood out. And I put he understood he was likely going to die. And how do you function at the level that he functioned, knowing that you're doing this, you know, you're putting your life on the line for, if that's the case, if you think you're going to die, you're putting your life on the line for nothing, because if you die, the message is not getting to those soldiers. Right. So if you think this is a mission that's not going to be successful, then essentially you're just saying, like, yep, I'm either going to stand here and battle someone and probably get shot, or I'm going to take this trip and, you know, try to save thousands of lives. And, you know, sure enough, he sort of pulls it off, you know.
I think the best choice they made for the people on screen are, you know, if you want to call them cameos, that's basically what they are because they're so quick. But the three most famous people in this movie are Colin Firth, Mark Strong, and Benedict Cumberbatch. And I think it's, they probably could have had more famous people be the two leads. But I think they did a great job of casting two guys that give a good performance. But then how they use the more famous people, I think, makes them feel so much more important. Because, like, if you think back to the situation that these guys were in, meeting a captain or meeting a general or whoever would have been a big deal. Probably, like, you know, you knew their names. They, you know, they are these guys that are put up on these pedestals. And have it being such famous people be those three moments, I think makes us as an audience feel like, oh, they are that important. Like, they just come in real quick and, like, it almost puts us in the same spot of, like, oh, I actually know that person. Like, that's because everybody else in this is nameless. I mean, I know a couple more people. Richard Madden pops up at the end. Fantastic in that 2 minutes. I mean, that is top of the line performance that he gives, finding out that his brother passed away. But for the most part, this is faceless actors for 90% of this movie, except those three little moments where those guys pop in. And really, I mean, for them, you show up on set for probably a few hours one day, get a paycheck, but you've got to bring it with everything you got, and they do, and all three of those moments are fantastic. Especially Benedict Cumberbatch's.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely stole the show in that regard. But I do think you raise a good point, which is if the spectacle of war was supposed to be kind of your lead character, and then if you also in that process want to make it more realistic where you have the same response they might have by showing up and seeing a general or seeing a colonel or something like that who you've heard, you know their names, And that does give, I hadn't thought of that way, but that does give the audience a similar emotional response to what you might imagine, you know, a foot soldier who is sent out across all of these enemy lines to go find these people might have had when they finally see them. So, yeah, that's pretty well done, probably.
So you said that he stole that. Do you think he was the best of everyone that popped into this? Because I think it's him, for sure. That is Benedict Cumberbatch. He gave the best performance of anyone that just, like, walked in.
Yeah, I would say so.
I mean, for sure. There's probably not. I mean, there was an energy that, who was the guy that walks to the back of the truck and...
Mark Strong?
Is that...
The captain that, like, brings him with him?
I knew who the guy was, but, like, he gave an energy in that, just the couple line performance that was really good, but, yeah, I would have not, you know... measured up to what Benedict Cumberbatch did, for sure.
I want to take it a little bit differently here. I mean, if it ends up being if we repeat ourselves later, that's fine. Before we get to favorite scene, what is the most stressful scene of this movie, in your guys' opinion? Because I think, I mean, they lean on that a lot. They lean on, like, trying to get your heart rate brought up because something stressful is happening in such a short amount of time. Which scene do you think does that the absolute best? I can go for example, to me it's the tunnel scene underground. Like, I felt like it was hard for me to breathe. I remember thinking back in the theater watching it when that stuff falls on him, and then imagining having to jump across that. And it's maybe like a 3 foot gap, but if you can just imagine being blind and having to do like it, like that scene is the one to me that was the most effective in that, but there are so many where they try to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. He didn't even say, if I remember right, he didn't even tell him how big the gap was. He just said jump.
Yeah, he's like, just jump, just go for it.
And I'm like, why don't you say, hey, it's a 2-foot gap,
right?
Jump, you know, or they would have said meter or...
Yeah, I mean, Brad, I want you to know, like, if we find ourselves in a similar situation, I will absolutely tell you it's a 1-foot gap instead of a jump.
Just take a step.
Even if it's like 10 feet, just because I want you to have confidence.
Yeah. Yeah, I wrote down, to answer your question, and then I'll comment on the scene you just said. I think to me it's probably when that guy is like running right at him, shooting, you're like, oh my God, how's he going to get out of this? Like, and where did this guy come from? And you don't even know who or where or what the enemies are at this point, because he's in this place that's essentially just, you know, looking like fireworks are going off or something. So to me, that was probably the most stressful. But I put on here how nice a move it was to have the rat set off that explosive.
Yep.
You know, like, it was such a good touch of like, oh wait, this wasn't human error. They were being careful and they did it. And it, sure enough, it was this rat that was down there messing around that darn near kills them. You know, right. That was a good move, I think, for them to do that.
Yeah, the most consequential rat that we've had in the 101 movies we've watched now, officially replacing the rat at the end of The Departed.
Yes.
So I would just, the third scene that I would put out there is, I think that the sniper while he's crossing the broken bridge is a particularly good scene with the stress and the way that they filmed it. You couldn't see what he was jumping down into.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's crossing this river. He ends up on some sort of a platform, but then comes around to the stairs and there's another shot there. And so I thought that scene was particularly well done in terms of the stress.
Well, they do such a good job of, like, I think when he cuts his hand and then tries to balance himself and puts it in a dead body, like, that's something so, you know, it's not grotesque in the way of, like, in war movies we see, you know, bones sticking out of people or guts hanging around, but, like, you know what that is. And I remember at that time I was like, is somehow this guy gonna die from an infection? Maybe he did later, but, like, you just know in that moment of, like, oh God, like, there's that. When he's crawling over those bodies in the river, they just do such a good job of, like, I think this movie could have been, I mean, it's still rated R. Yeah, it's still rated R. But it could have been grotesque in a lot of ways, and it's really not. But they present this stuff in a way of, they don't need it to be grotesque for you to feel how intense it is. I mean, even, like, when, I already forget his name, I know it's three names. Dean Chapman? Is that his last name?
Hold, please. Dean Charles Chapman.
Dean Charles Chapman. Even his death scene. There's been a million more violent death scenes in war films,
mm-hmm.
but it's so impactful because you feel his pain when he's trying to stand up. He's begging him not to carry him to safety because he's in so much pain. Like, that stuff, I like that they chose to go for, like, nuance over just, here's someone's head exploding. Especially in a movie like about World War One, like, they could have been way more violent. They chose to go for things that had a little more meaning and impact.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess to me, I would look at it almost differently, because watching someone's head get hit with a bullet, to me, is less violent than watching somebody get stabbed up close like that because of the, I guess, the passion, I guess, it takes to want to kill a person and to repeatedly stab them over and over. I guess it was a couple of, I don't remember exactly how he did it.
So maybe grotesque is the right word. Not violent. They're not trying to shock us. It's just trying to be more realistic.
But to me, that's what made it more shocking, because you're like, you're almost expecting an explosion or a shot or something to take these guys out. And it's, the shocking part is, it's, they're trying to essentially save somebody's life and it costs them their life, you know. And I remember the first time I watched it thinking, like, oh my God, really? Like, this is what's going to get him, you know? And to me, that, it almost made it more shocking that the guy didn't just pull out a gun and,
And from that, I mean, from the beginning of the movie, you can tell which one of these guys is actually a soldier, and the one that survives is actually the soldier, right? Like, he, I mean, Dean Chapman, Harry Dean Stanton, whatever his name is.
Dean Charles?
Dean Charles Chapman. He's not a he's at war, but he is not a soldier. Like, the decisions he makes time and time again, it was obvious.
A child, you know?
Yeah, it's obvious that he was probably going to be the one today, because in a realistic setting, there's I get morally absolutely, but you can't stop and help that guy, and that's like what. And the other guy, he's telling him like, no, we do not need to give him water. Like, we need to go. Like, not that we need to sit here and enjoy this guy dying, but like, this is not a part of our plan, mm-hmm. and it cost him his life. Like, it's, so I think it does a really, really good job in a different way of explaining the horrors of war.
While we're on that scene, I wrote down, why did they need to, his line was, why did they have to make sure that the house was abandoned? Like, there was really no good reason for them to go over there, right? Like, unless they think that they're going to get sniped or something. But if they're thinking they're going to get sniped, they're walking very cavalierly over to this house. Like, he made the line of, we have to make sure this is abandoned. And I was thinking, like, why? Your mission is to get to this front line and give these directions. Why do you have to stop and make sure no one's squatting in this house? Then it ends up costing them their life, yeah. because the plane crashes and all that. But, like, I guess I don't understand why, in their mind, this was a must. We have to go make sure there's no one in there.
I took it as they were assuming that people were now going to start coming across no man's land, and, like, they were going to move up people. And what if this house was booby-trapped, like what we just walked through? Like, they wanted to check it on behalf of their fellow soldiers that were coming behind them. It's how I've always taken it. But you're right. I mean, they detoured and it cost them. Like,
yeah. I also quoted, and I think it was in that same scene, he said, watch the ridge lines. And I don't know why I put that in quotes, but for some reason that line stood out to me that he delivered. I don't know if it was his, it wasn't his last line, because they had some dialogue as he was dying. But right. Is there anything that you guys remember about him saying, watch the ridge lines, is why I would have mm-hmm. written it down?
Not
here.
That I recall, but I mean, he may cool. have. But yeah, they may have been looking out to get you. But you're right. They kind of just waltz up there and then everything goes sideways. Let's do favorite scene, fellas, from 1917. I've kind of already alluded to mine, so I'll go first. But it's just the one shot, the actual true tracking shot of him running through the beginning of that battle. Like, so again, like the point of this movie is to look like it's all one shot. Of course it's not. There are cuts in this movie. They did not film this all in one take for an hour and however long. But him walking into that trench, looking for Benedict Cumberbatch's character, running up that hill, running through, that was all one take from, I think, the moment that he goes into that trench the first time all the way up until those dudes grab him to stop him from going in the bunker. That's all 1, 5, 6, however many minutes that is, take. And I think that is the most impressive thing I've ever seen in any war film, bar none. Maybe any action movie. Like that, all those hundreds of people, all that timing, the explosions going off. I mean, obviously they're not bombs that are going off, but those are charges that are going off, and people have to be in the right place at the right time to not get hit by them. They even add in him running into someone, mm-hmm. so you've got to factor in two people making contact, falling, getting up, moving through like that. I mean, that's just the craziest idea that I've ever seen. It's something as simple as just running across a field, but to execute it, that's the peak of this movie to me. It's the peak of any war movie, that little 4-minute stretch, however long it is. That's my favorite scene.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. I had that down easily as I watched it as my favorite scene in the movie. It's extremely well done, and I think that it's the peak of this movie in a lot of ways, because it's what this movie probably set out to be, which is it puts you in it. You're in the spectacle of war. You're seeing it. It's not about dialogue. It's not about anything other than this guy has to get from point A to point B, and to do it, he has to risk his life, which is the entire thing of this movie, right? But in that scene, you just see it so perfectly clear.
He does such a great job of conveying, like, the thought process of, like, he checks and looks down and kind of looks at the people in front of him, and you can see him without saying anything, thinking, like, am I really going to do this? Is this really the only option? And then he doesn't even necessarily take off. Like, he gets out and he's walking, and he's kind of starting, like, he picks up speed gradually because he's still kind of second-guessing it, and, like, I think they did a really good job with it.
My favorite scene is the one I've been talking about the most, and that is where they were at the house and the plane crash and the stabbing, and simply because, and we've talked about this too, it was just such an awkward way to have him die. stabbing at the hands of one individual that he's trying to save, and the fact that they don't even show the original stab, you hear, you know, yeah. he's getting the water, and you hear the skirmish, I guess you want to, whatever you want to call it, between the two, and then he turns around and he sees his friend has been stabbed. So, and I guess, yeah, it would still, both times that I watch it, I still stop to think, like, why? Why did they even go over there? And, you know, potentially this guy could still be alive had they not. But, yeah, that was my favorite scene.
That's one of the rare moments of a movie I've seen in theaters. Like, I mean, I always go to the Marvel movies the first night they come out, right? Because I don't want anything ruined for me. And that always brings a crowd of people reacting very loudly in the theater, and I've gotten used to that, whether I like it or not or whatever. That's one of the few times in a non-superhero movie that I've heard quite a loud response from a crowd at a movie. Because, I mean, it was a pretty packed house that night. It was a Friday night, whatever. Like, it was pretty sold out. And you go into this assuming that Harry Dean Stanton is the main character, right? Like, that he's the guy. I'm just going to keep calling him that.
Harry Dean Stanton.
That he's the main character.
Dean Norris?
Yeah.
That's who he was, right?
And John Hamm. And when you turn around and John Hamm is getting stabbed, like, it's shocking. And I remember that entire theater, like, that collective gasp, like, oh, God. Like, mm-hmm. And you kind of think, like, maybe he'll be okay. Like, I don't know, because most movies, like, you'd find a way. But once he starts pulling the layers off, you're like, oh, God, like, yeah, he's toast. Mm-hmm. So, interesting choice. All right, that will wrap up our conversation of 1917, everyone. Or favorite line. We can talk about favorite line, too. Maybe my favorite line was just anything that Harry Dean, John Hamm, Stanton said. But do you guys have any favorite lines from this movie?
Yeah, I wrote down... I had hoped today, this was the one from Benedict Cumberbatch, I'd hoped today would be a good day. Then he says, hope is a dangerous thing. And then I think I'm paraphrasing from here, he says something about last man standing, and yep. then he says, fuck off, Lieutenant Corporal. Yep. And you always, I think in that moment, you're like, okay, this guy shows up and he has this important message. Just take the message and listen to what he's saying. But he's showing you how much pressure is on just this one decision. And, you know, it takes that little convincing. And then once he's convinced, he's right back to business. And he's like, you know, get out of my face. I've got other things to worry about. So, yeah, just very well done line, well delivered by him.
Wrong hand.
yeah, agreed.
Which... is also a line that could have played well in our movie that we're doing next week. So, but it wasn't in that movie.
What movie are we doing next week?
Which movie is that, Mike?
Well, we're doing From Dusk Till Dawn.
Oh, okay, cool. All right. And now everybody knows that.
This entire line could have played well in that, too.
Yes, it could have. I'm in agreement with Brad. I think this is the best one. Like I said, I think Benedict Cumberbatch is the best person that walks in to this movie, any of the famous people. Not a line that gets said, but I think something that was so impactful was getting down to the end of the movie, and he pulls that picture out of what I'm assuming is his wife and daughter, and he flips it over, and I think it just says, like, come back to us. So that's not spoken aloud, but to go through this entire movie with this guy, and it makes sense then, like, how committed he was, not that I enjoyed that scene, but he wants to take care of that baby and that woman. The fact that we went through this and never even had an inkling that he was a family man. I think someone asked him at one point, and he kind of just ignores the question, if I'm remembering it right. But then we get down to, he is a family man. He's just kind of got that part of him turned off because of how horrifying all this stuff is, and then he just keeps that and gives himself that little reminder. But I thought that was a pretty good
I think you'd have to shut that off,
yeah.
Because if you're thinking about what you have to lose in every moment, like, you know, it's get home, get home, get home, get home, and yeah, I think that very wise to shut that part off.
I thought that was a great way to cap off the movie. So yeah, that will do it. And as Mike just let us know, next week we are talking From Dusk Till Dawn. Very, very different film. It's going to be a very different conversation. We hope that you join us for it. Other than that, guys, for Mike, for Brad, I'm Ethan, and we'll see you next time.